So we are looking at this passage that we read a moment ago, Romans chapter 13, verses 1 to 7. I don't really have an introduction, but I do have a question, and I have two answers to that question. The question is, why should Christians submit to the authorities? It's a very straightforward question, and as you can see, it is the question which consumes this whole passage that we're about to consider. Why should Christians submit to the authorities? And I have two answers to that question. And the first is this: because Christians are God-fearers. Christians are God-fearers. Let me begin with the thing in this passage which I think we find most difficult to understand, which we're most reluctant to accept, which we're most eager to qualify, and yet which Paul seems most eager to tell us and tells us most plainly. And it's this: that the governing authorities, the governments of this world and the government that we currently live under in this country, have been instituted by God. It's very simple. That's what Paul says. He says it again and again and again in this passage. It's the very assumption of this passage. Verse 1, there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Verse 2, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed. Verse 4, he is God's servant who carries out God's wrath. Verse 6, the authorities are ministers of God. Paul is very clear. He's very plain. It's not something that we think about very much. It's something that we probably find a bit difficult to accept in some ways, but Paul is very plain about it. Why do we have the governments that we do in this world? We can answer that question through history. We can answer that question through political philosophy. We could answer that question through sociology. Why is it that Keir Starmer is our Prime Minister right now? Well, he was elected, wasn't he, to the House of Commons in 2015. He took over the leadership of the Labour Party in 2020, and then back in July we voted for that party. Why is King Charles the king right now? Well, he was the firstborn son of Queen Elizabeth II. He was born into that position. And in other countries of the world, it's not all fair elections and hereditary. There's fear, there's corruption, there's manipulation. All of those are answers to the question, why do we have the authorities that we do? That is the way that the societies are the way that they are. And we Christians don't disagree with any of that. But we Christians do have an additional answer to those answers I've just provided. We have an additional layer to our thinking. We have a supernatural layer to our thinking. And we might be embarrassed about this, but Paul again tells us very plainly that the governments of this world have been instituted by God. And I think he means more than just God's providence, in a general sense, has put these authorities over us. No, he means that these authorities rightly derive their authority from God and have been put in place by God specifically, and have been done so for our good, as he says in verse 4. And I think we can actually expand this, probably beyond just governmental authority. Paul is saying that there is no authority in verse 1 except from God. I think we could add to that authority in the family, or authority in the workplace, or authority in the classroom, or authority in the church. All of this is part of God's gracious design for human beings, for Christians, for our good. That is Paul's view of things, and that should be our view of things. And so God then has instituted all authority, and by submitting to those authorities, we submit to God. If we fear God, we will fear the authorities God has put over us. Now, of course, even in the very best of human societies, governance is imperfect. And obviously then, Paul is not arguing for our absolute obedience to the authorities. You know, we find ourselves in countries with inconsistent laws and confusing laws and petty laws and laws that at times blatantly contradict God's law. So clearly, Paul's not arguing for absolute obedience to our rulers. Nor is he saying that every time we accidentally drive into a bus lane or something like that, we have committed some kind of cardinal sin. No, we don't want to sort of to find ourselves thinking simplistically like that. But nevertheless, generally speaking, these authorities are placed there for our good, and by obeying the authorities, we obey God. Verse 7, Paul tells us that we pay honour and respect to our authorities. And again, we want to qualify that a little bit, because there's also a place for doing what Jesus does and for calling the Herods of this world foxes and the Pharisees of this world vipers. Jesus is prepared to, in a sense, dishonour them. And actually, it's worth noting that Paul never actually uses the word obey, even in this whole passage. So he's not saying, it's not about saying, you know, I will do everything the authorities tell me to do under all conditions. But the word that he does use in this passage, and that he uses it there in verse 1, he says, let every person be subject to, or let every person submit to the governing authorities. It's the same word that he uses elsewhere to describe the relationship of wives to husbands, or slaves to masters, or children to parents. So it's not about saying, I will do everything this person tells me to, but at least it is about adopting a posture, a disposition, an acceptance of the authority that God has put over us, and an appreciation of the fact that it is actually for our good. And that's the point, isn't it? Authority is not a bad thing. It's a God-given thing. Yes, we do obey God rather than men, as Peter says. But in most cases, what it means to obey God is to obey the men he has put over us. And so to go back to my heading then, I think we can rightly say that we obey the authorities because we fear God. Because we are God-fearers. When we get on the wrong side of the authorities, we are getting on the wrong side of God's ministers. And so I want us to think seriously then about this morning. Are you a God-fearer? Do you use that phrase to describe yourself? Is that an accurate description of who you are? Are you a God-fearer? You know, part of what it means for Christians to fear God is to keep his commandments. We fear God and keep his commandments, as Ecclesiastes tells us. Well, let me ask you this question. How often do you think about the fifth commandment? Honour your father and mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. Honour your father and mother. How often do you think about that commandment and the place of that in your life? And I bring that up because the fifth commandment is about the relationship between children and parents, yes, but behind that commandment, clearly there's a deeper principle which has a serious importance for the running of Israel, and it's this. It's the principle is how we relate to authority more generally. And this is something which God really cares about. It's something that we can perhaps minimize in our own culture, but it is something that God really cares about. And if you're not sure about that, just read the Law of Moses, or just read through the book of Proverbs, or just read through the epistles. And you'll find, actually, surprisingly, the same message coming through again and again and again, that God's people acknowledge and respect the authority he has put over them, whether that be in the home, whether that be in the marriage, whether that be in the workplace, whether that be in the nation, relating to the state. We find it again and again and again. In the words of 1 Peter 2:17, fear God, honour the king. We honour the king because we are God-fearers. And so let's take this seriously. There is a place for criticising, and criticising harshly, our leaders. There is a place for satirizing our leaders, for making fun of our leaders. There is a place even for disobeying our leaders. But all of that being true, we must be careful about this. And probably we're not careful enough about this. Have you ever noticed just how much our culture loves the rebel? Our culture loves rebels, doesn't it? Maybe you've seen that picture of that one German man refusing to salute Hitler as Hitler parades past and everyone else are saluting, and that one man is standing there with his arms folded. Or perhaps you've seen that picture of that one Chinese man at Tiananmen Square, and he's blocking the path of four big Chinese tanks, and he's standing there defiantly. And we love that kind of thing, don't we? It rouses our hearts to see that kind of principled courage. And that is a good thing, of course. And Christians as well love that kind of thing. And we think of our own examples. We think of Christians like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who became a martyr to the Nazis. So we think of Corrie ten Boom defying the Nazis and hiding Jews in her house. We love that kind of thing. It stirs us. We love the rebel. And in those cases, that is understandable given our recent history, and it is also good that we celebrate that courage. I will fear God rather than man. But probably for this very reason, we do need to be careful. Because contrary to popular belief, the ones who are in charge over us aren't always and at all times our enemies. Actually, Romans 13 tells us that generally speaking, most of the time, they are there for our good. And by submitting to them, we honour our God. Christians are not anti-authoritarian. We want to avoid rebellion. We want to avoid revolution. And so for all then that we want us to hold our authorities accountable, we want to do that with care. We don't want to become what the false teachers mentioned in 2 Peter did, and to use Peter's words, despise authority. That is not what we're like as Christians. We don't despise authority. That is a false gospel. That is a false kind of Christianity as far as Peter's concerned. Those who despise authority. And so we don't take a casual approach to the laws of the land around us. We don't stop paying our taxes. We don't refuse to turn up to court. We don't drive at whatever speed gives us pleasure as we are hurtling down the motorway. No, we submit to their authority. They don't hold the sword in vain. And when we hear of stories of Christians being arrested, sometimes those Christians are arrested for doing what is right and for taking a principled stance, and we celebrate their courage and we condemn the authorities in those cases. But there are plenty of other examples of Christians who get arrested for doing stupid things. And when we see a Christian in prison for doing something stupid, our first thought shouldn't be martyr. Our first thought should be moron. Our first thought should be that man does not fear God because he does not fear the authorities God has placed over him. And so, I know this is a basic point, and I don't have an awful lot of detail to go into here, but I'm just wanting you to scrutinize yourself. What is your attitude towards authority? Have you breathed in too much of the air of our culture, which loves the rebel, and loves the revolutionary spirit, and loves the upstart, and loves the one who is insubordinate and doesn't like submitting? We all like that a little bit, don't we? We need to make sure we don't let that get out of hand. What is our attitude towards the law? What is our attitude towards the politicians, towards the police? Do we submit to them? Are we grateful for them? Do we recognize them? It's interesting what Paul says in verse 5 here. He seems to say that actually something in our consciences does recognize that the authority held by those above us is legitimate and does bind us in certain respects morally. Our consciences recognize that fact. He says in verse 5, Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath. It's not just that you fear going into prison, but also for the sake of conscience, he says. For the same reason, you also pay your taxes, for the authorities are God's ministers attending to this very thing. So why do we pay our taxes? Well, Paul's saying it's not just fear of imprisonment. That's not the only thing which is making us pay our taxes to fund things going on in the wider society which we would condemn. No, we pay our taxes for a deeper reason than that. We know it's morally right. We know that those God has put over us do rightly demand our money. We are paying God's ministers, after all, Paul says. Suppose let me just finish this point by saying this. You know, if there is still part of you which is uncomfortable with the idea of submission, and it is a dirty word in our society, people do think of submission as being a demeaning thing, it's a grovelling thing, isn't it? That's exactly what our society wants us to think. Well, just remember this. I think this is a really crucial and interesting thing to remember. It's one thing for Paul to teach this. It's another thing for Jesus to practice it. But that's what he does. Jesus practices this. Remember, even Jesus, King of Kings himself, Lord of Lords himself, was born under the authority and the institutions of the world, the sinful, fallen world. And part of what it meant for him, the Son of God no less, to be truly human, was for him to honour the men, the fallen, sinful, corrupt men, who God had placed over him. Even when those men were vastly incompetent compared to his competence, and totally wicked, and far less qualified than him to rule, nevertheless, Jesus submits to their authority. He's even prepared to put his own money into the hands of a wicked Roman Empire when they ask for it. Jesus tells us to do the same thing. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, he says. He recognizes that those authorities rightly demand our taxes. And it's not then that Jesus is just a pushover. It's not that Jesus was a coward, a weakling, that he was just a sheep who followed the crowd. No, Jesus was a God-fearer. Jesus saw it as part of his moral responsibility to submit to God by submitting to the authorities God had put over him. And so I'm just bringing that to you now. If you see yourself as a rebel this morning, realize that Jesus didn't. He submitted to the powers that were over him. So we submit because we are God-fearers. But then secondly, why do we submit to the governing authorities? We submit because we are peacemakers. We submit because we are peacemakers. See, I want to sort of step out of the details of this passage for a moment, and I want to just ask the bigger question. And it's a question that I haven't addressed this morning, but I think it's an obvious question. And the question is this: what is Romans 13 verses 1 to 7 doing here? What is this passage doing here? And I don't mean why is Paul saying what he's saying? I mean, why is he saying it at this point in the book of Romans? You know, what we need to do as Christians is stitch together the book of Romans and understand it as a cohesive whole, understand the argument from start to finish. And the question then we need to ask is, how do we understand Romans 13, 1 to 7 in the context of the surrounding chapters? And that is actually quite a tricky question, isn't it? Because last week, what did we say about these surrounding chapters? Well, we said that chapters 12 to 15 are chapters which deal with the Christian life, and what the Christian life looks like. These are the chapters where Paul gives us imperatives, commands, tells us how to behave. But more than that, and more specifically, last week we said that these chapters are about one thing in particular, They're all about love. And that was quite clear in our previous passage, because we saw then that Paul is telling us that love ought to be genuine. And he goes on then to speak about how love impacts different parts of our lives, how it affects our relationships in the church, how it affects our relationships outside of the church. That's quite clear, that passage. That's about love. The following passage is also quite clear. Paul goes on to tell us how we fulfill the law through love, how our love for one another is a fulfillment of the law itself. And as Paul goes on through chapters 14 and 15, he will tell us that we love each other by not passing judgment on each other, by not causing each other to stumble, by imitating the example of Christ. In all of these ways, then, this underlying theme is there, genuine Christian love. But at first sight, chapter 13, verses 1 to 7, doesn't really seem to be about love at all, does it really? I mean, what does honouring the authorities have to do with Christian love? Is Paul just off on a little tangent here? Is he discussing something different? And he's quite entitled to do that if he wants to. He can go on tangents if he likes. Sometimes he does. Is that what he's doing in these verses? Well, perhaps we could see it this way. Perhaps we could all fit it together this way. Last week, we saw that love, true, genuine Christian love, is not a little thing which occupies one department of our life, but rather is a big, profound, life-changing thing which affects every department of our life. We read from 1 Corinthians 13, didn't we? And we get a big view of love in that chapter. Love is not just this little thing. No, love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. So Christian love is more than just smiles and hugs and a friendly face. It's more than just fluffy feelings. And it's more than just a duty. No, 1 Corinthians 13 tells us that true love is this great, encompassing attitude of the Christian life which changes everything about us and affects all our relationships, both inside and outside the church. And the more of this love we have, the more patient we are with people, the less we feel the need to boast about ourselves, the less we envy each other, the less we resent each other, the less we rejoice at each other's wrongdoings. We don't get a kick out of each other's failures. Love is long-suffering. It bears all things. It desperately desires the good of other people and is therefore patient in waiting for that good to come about. It's generous towards others. It believes all things. It isn't skeptical. It's not critical. It's not pessimistic. You see, love then, Christian love, it completely transforms every part of our lives. We have a small view of love sometimes, and Paul presents us with this big view of love. And as we saw in the previous passage then, love, it abhors what is evil, it clings to what is good, it is affectionate, it affects our emotions, it honours others, it unites us in our ups and downs. And as far as our relationships outside the church are concerned, Christians love their enemies. What a radical idea that is. Christians love their enemies. They don't want to repay evil for evil. They overcome evil with good. They leave vengeance to the Lord. And in particular, Paul tells us in chapter 12, verse 18, we seek to live peaceably with all men. So this is the point I'm arriving at here. Christian love makes us peacemakers. Because we love our enemies, we don't want war and strife and bitterness and hostility with them. Yes, we don't want to compromise on our own values, of course. But nevertheless, what we want with those people is peace. We want peace. Jesus himself says, does he not, at the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. Jesus tells us that when we strive for peace in this world, we show ourselves to be sons of God. That is, we reflect the nature of our Father. Our Father is a God who loves peace. Romans 16 calls him the God of peace. He is coming to bring peace to this world. Jesus Christ is the Prince of Peace. And we, because we love each other and we love the world, desire peace. And I would say then that this is the very thing then that helps us to understand the place of Romans 13, 1-7 in the wider stretches of this book. Because one of the ways in which our love should be visible is the way in which we conduct ourselves as good, peaceful, peace-seeking citizens. In the words of 1 Timothy chapter 2, we are told to be people who pray for kings and for all who are in high positions, that we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way. We do not want to be people who are known, who are infamous for subversion and disruption and rebellion. We are people who are known for peace. And yes, people might want to construe us, might want to portray us as rebels and upstarts. But for all we might believe the most radical things in the world, and for all we might hold to the most radical principles in the world, and for all we might even possess such a commitment to the kingship of Jesus Christ that we are not prepared to worship Caesar himself, and that might really wind him up, nevertheless, for the most part, we honour our leaders more than anyone else, more even than the average pagan on the street who pays lip service to the worship of Caesar. We honour Caesar more than that man. And even at times that means patiently suffering under Caesar. So this is what Christian love does to a man or a woman or a boy or a girl. It makes them a peacemaker. And that, I think, is what Paul is promoting in this passage. And I stress this to us now because it's very easy, isn't it, for us to belittle the virtue of peacemaking. It's very easy for us to think, peacemaking, what is that? It's not much. It's a silly, cowardly little thing, really, isn't it, peacemaking? Have you ever thought about what people might have thought when Jesus stands on that mountain and he says, blessed are the peacemakers? There'll have been people in that crowd who, from that moment on, think that Jesus is a sellout. People who hear those words and think, actually, Jesus isn't as zealous for God's kingdom as he claims to be. You think of people like the Zealots. Who were the Zealots? The Zealots were freedom fighters. The Zealots were people who thought that what Israel needed was to wake up and to kick out the Romans. And you can imagine how a man living in Israel in the first century would find himself thinking like that. I mean, just think about it. There you are, this first century Jew. You've spent your whole life living under Roman rule. It's all that you've ever known. And suddenly one day it's as if you wake up and you think, hang on a moment, this is God's city, isn't it? And we're God's people, aren't we? And we're living as slaves under these pagans, these Romans. And it disturbs you just how normal it's become. Roman authorities standing on every street corner, every gateway, walking the streets, enjoying their privileges. Roman money in your hands, blasphemous. Roman money in your hands. Roman artwork on every wall. Roman buildings constructed all around the place. Roman culture flourishing around you. And it disturbs you that your friends could just go around the place without questioning any of this, as if it was completely natural. Don't they realise it shouldn't be like this? Don't you take your Jewish religion seriously enough? And so this man then, he becomes a zealot. And political resistance seems like the only right, zealous response to a wicked Roman Empire. And it's very difficult to challenge that way of thinking, isn't it? Because zeal is a good thing. Paul himself has told us in the previous chapter not to be slothful in zeal. And that's what the zealots were all about, their zeal. Zealotry appeared glamorous, it appeared dramatic, it appeared heroic. And I'm not saying then that political resistance is never an option. But what I think Paul would be quick to tell us is this, that this zealot spirit is also dangerously impulsive. And contrary to what Paul has been commanding in the previous few verses of Romans 12, a zealot could very easily be an impatient person, a person who cannot let vengeance belong to the Lord, but has to take it into their own hands right now. An ungenerous person, a spiteful person, a person who prefers conflict to peace, a person who wants the fight for the sake of the fight, who wants to pay back evil for evil. That's what a zealot becomes like. And a person who then will not and cannot and must not submit to those pagan authorities. And even if that means then pulling the whole country down into some kind of bloodbath, and so many revolutions did result in that, and in fact AD 70, which was in part a result of Jewish uprisings, did result in a bloodbath, then so be it. I'm happy with that. I'm not submitting to these authorities. So that's the impulsive zealot spirit. And for all its valour then, and for all its glamour, and for all its drama, it's at risk of being entirely loveless and not caring anything for peace. And that is the spirit Paul is telling us to avoid. And we need to be careful about this. Because zealotry isn't a thing of the past. And I'm not talking about, you know, real political violence in the Christian church, and thankfully there's very little of that. But there is a particular kind of man or woman who I think very easily finds themselves caught up in this kind of spirit. You think about that man who just reads that one newspaper, or who just listens to that one YouTuber, or who just listens to that one preacher, and his whole life then is being channeled down this one path. And what's this man's verdict of the world around him and the church around him and the nation around him? Well, it's completely skeptical. The church has completely apostatized, he thinks to himself. Most of her teachers are false. There's very few Christians, true Christians, left in the world. The country has become completely corrupt. Every film has a secretly anti-Christian message. The global elites all secretly worship Satan. The politicians are all perverted. Every law which they pass brings the country closer to hell. And only this tiny handful of Christians are left. And one day, very soon, they'll all be behind bars. And somehow this man even manages to fall out with those few Christians who are left. And this kind of man, I think, is surprisingly common in the church. And it's not that he's a political zealot in the old-fashioned sense. But it is that this man, slowly but surely, article by article, YouTube video by YouTube video, is being drained of his love and his desire for peace. And he is at risk then of becoming consumed by hatred and anger and aggression. And yes, he might have woken up to the latest move to liberalise abortion law. And yes, he treats that very seriously. And yes, threats to Christian freedom might be something which the people around him haven't noticed, and he has, and he makes a big deal about it. And yes, he'll bravely put his head above the parapet and wander in and weigh into debates on LGBT issues on Twitter or social media or whatever. But why is he doing that? Is it really because he loves his neighbour and desires peace with his neighbour, or could it actually be because of self-love, because he enjoys being seen as a radical, because he likes being on the battlefield, because he wants for himself an appearance of valor. And so I say to you this morning, then, I hope you're not at risk of becoming that man or that woman. And don't get me wrong, things in this world are very bad. Probably they're worse than you think. Probably that zealot has seen much evil in this world, which many of us are closing our eyes to. And probably before we leave this place, things might have become even worse. But as we said last week, our way to respond to that is, yes, we should fight for truth, and we should fight for justice, and we should fight for righteousness. But the way we do that, nevertheless, is to love and to honour the very people around us who seem to be making our lives worse. Never compromising, never giving in to cowardice, exposing sin. Yes, that's true. But at the same time, being patient and generous towards our enemies, viewing them in the best light we possibly can, and that might be a very dim light, and desiring peace with them wherever possible, and honouring whatever authority God has given them over us. If you want a radical approach to the world, the radical Christian approach is not just to speak truth to power, which is the popular expression these days, but it's to speak the truth in love, as Paul says in Ephesians 4. Of course, one of the most frustrating things about this is that evangelical Christians today are often described as haters, aren't they? They're described in the very opposite terms to what we would strive for. That's the accusation people throw at us. It's one of the ways they like to portray us, haters. Well, I'm saying to you, let us disprove that accusation in the very way that we respond to it. Because the more lovingly we endure that kind of slander, the more obviously false that accusation will appear. And the less we will seem like haters, and the more hopefully attractive we will become. Let me just finish this sermon with a little bit of Christian history. So we've been reading through the book of Romans, and most scholars would tell us that the book of Romans was written around AD 57 is the date which they often go for. Can't be absolutely sure about that, but sometime in the mid-50s looks about right. Well, 7 years after AD 57, so AD 64, something happened in Rome. The city caught fire. About two-thirds of it burnt down. It was a devastating fire. And Emperor Nero then, he needed someone to blame. And he blamed the Christians. Now, evidently, this was clearly a fabrication, because even the Roman historian Tacitus takes it for granted that Nero made this up, and Tacitus was there at the time, and Tacitus didn't even like Christians himself. But nevertheless, this is the accusation which was made. And it's interesting then to read the words of Tacitus and to see what he says about Nero and how he treated the Christians. He says this: Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. It's interesting. Tacitus clearly assumes that we really won't know what he's talking about when he mentions Christians. He probably thinks that this little sect will be there 1 minute and disappear the next. Who knows who these Christians are? He feels the need to explain himself. And at this point then, Tacitus actually goes on to talk about Jesus. Actually, he's the earliest non-Christian source to refer to Jesus. He doesn't realize his name. He calls him Christus. But this is what he says. He says, Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. So we have some non-Christian factual evidence there. But anyway, this is the interesting thing. Notice what he goes on to say. Notice what he says these Christians are then accused of. He says, accordingly, an arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty, and we can imagine they've pled guilty under terrible torture, then upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted. Not so much of the crime of firing the city, he says, as of hatred against mankind. It's interesting, isn't it? It seems to be a very typical line of attack. These Christians hate everyone. They are haters. That is the reason that they are ultimately tortured. That they're blamed for the fire, and then there's this additional accusation that they are haters of mankind. And so we're told then what Nero does to these Christians, and it's very unpleasant. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths, covered with the skins of beasts. They were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the fires and burned to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired. Horrible, isn't it? So perhaps you hear all of that then, you think, well, what use was their love, after all? What use was their honouring the authorities? I mean, even after the Apostle Paul has made himself very clear and has written this letter to tell Christians to love their enemies, to respect the authorities, Nero still accuses them of burning down the city and hating mankind, and they are horribly put to death. But here's the thing. A few hundred years later, things will be very, very, very different. The national religion of that very empire will be Christianity. The Roman emperor himself will be calling himself a Christian. Why the change? What happens? Well, I think the answer partly lies in what Tacitus now goes on to say. He says, hence, even for criminals, referring to these Christians, who deserved extreme and exemplary punishment, there arose a feeling of compassion. See, the people of Rome had seen many people die, but something about seeing these Christians die was different. For all they might have been told that these were criminals and haters of the world, the sight of their deaths somehow aroused compassion, aroused sympathy. It raised questions. And thus I would put it to you, the weapon of love begins to strike the people of Rome. And in a few hundred years' time, that weapon has revolutionized the entire empire, and Christianity has become the dominant religion. And so let me end then by saying this. Last week we discussed the weapon of love, and on the face of things, that sounds like a very silly kind of expression. You know, when you're bullied and when you're slandered, the weapon of love, just living this good and peaceful life and suffering patiently and being generous towards your enemies, that looks totally feeble, doesn't it? And no doubt Christians thought that as they were being thrown to the dogs. Submitting to the authorities, it looks boring, it looks unglamorous, it looks demeaning. Part of us would rather pick up our swords and fight. But here's the thing, in a sense, that weapon of love, in the end, conquers the Roman Empire itself, with all its lies and all its swords and all its spears and all its lions and all its dogs. These little Roman Christians submitting to their authorities, loving their brothers, loving their enemies, revolutionize the world and the empire they live within. They overcome evil with good. We don't know what the future holds for this country, and I'm not making any kind of prediction on what the future does hold for this country. But I will simply say that if we imitate this Christ-like example and love each other and love our enemies, that will have an impact. At the very least, it will convict those who convict us. And we pray then that one day, even in this land, once again, evil will be overcome with good. Amen.